So, come up to the lab and see what's on the slab. I see you shiver with anticipation.
Bienvenue and welcome on the Slab, votre émission sur la science ici à Grenoble et dans le monde entier. Je ne suis pas dans le studio parce que c'est les temps de Covid. Je suis chez moi et aussi chez elle. Nous avons Lucille. Bonjour Lucille.
Hey, we are back.
Et Erin. Bonjour Erin.
Good evening, everybody. Hello, Andrew. Hello, Lucille. From my bedroom here in Grenoble.
J'espère que tu es bien habillée
pour
faire l'émission à poil. Il y a beaucoup de la science dans l'atmosphère aujourd'hui à cause de COVID et tout ça, mais on ne va pas parler de COVID pendant cette émission. Par contre, on va passer à l'Institut Laue Langevin et on va parler aux deux étudiants de TESA qui font leur thèse à l'Institut Laue Langevin, qui est une source de neutrons ici à Grenoble. Et ils sont aussi liés à l'Université Grenoble-Alpes. Donc, c'est un vrai plaisir pour les accueillir sur l'émission. Mais avant tout ça, Erin, est-ce qu'il y avait quelque chose dans la science qui t'attirait cette semaine?
In fact, there is, Andrew, and it's nothing to do with COVID at all, which is
good.
Good.
I've had enough of COVID.
Exactly. I think everybody's getting a little bit of fatigue. However, it is something that I came across this in the MIT Technology Review, which was just released. And there was an interview with a scientist, and she started her own company, as a lot of scientists do. And it's called Recompose. Can you guess what she does?
She writes music.
No, it's nothing to do with music.
No.
No, try again.
She writes poetry.
No. Let me continue.
She's alive, right? It's not we decompose.
Ah. Now you're on the right track. You are on the right track now. Keep going. Lucille, can you think of something?
Recomposer, je pense à la décomposition. Je pense aux légumes. Je ne sais pas pourquoi.
Oui, mais c'est pas mal. C'est pas mal.
De retourner en arrière.
Retourner vers la terre, en fait. Le truc, c'est le compostage, les cadavres.
Ah!
Ah!
Bon, the human cadavres.
Humans.
Les cadavres humains. Okay.
Humans, exactly. So, composting est devenu un truc fétiche, en fait, dans de plus en plus de villes en France et dans le monde, de composter ses restes alimentaires. Et en fait, ce qu'elle a pensé, cette scientifique américaine, pourquoi pas composter, en fait, les cadavres humains, les restes humains. Et donc, j'ai des chiffres qui sont, c'est frappant, c'est des chiffres pour les États-Unis. Donc, chaque année, ils utilisent 1 million acres, donc je crois que c'est plus grand qu'un hectare, de terre pour les cimetières et pour les jardins et pour the other things. I'm going to switch to English because it's all in American measures, sorry. 4 million acres of forest are cut down every year to build the boxes, you know, the caskets or the coffins. 800,000 gallons of embalming fluid, which is really very
toxic and nasty.
Toxic chemicals. Mm. Yeah, exactly. Now, that's per human body. It creates, in fact, in greenhouse gases, between 0.84 and 1.4 metric tons of CO2, which is
That's
the equivalent
amazing.
Per body, the equivalent of burning 500 kilograms of coal or driving 4,000 kilometers in a car, in a passenger car. So it's amazing.
So what do they do with the bodies then? They compost them, but how do they compost them?
Compost them, exactly. So it's small scale at the moment. As you can imagine, a lot of people go, what, when they hear about it.
But I like the idea, I must say. It's always appealed to me, the idea of going back to the earth.
Exactly, and you just become soil, precisely.
Yeah.
So they've got a big piece of forest. Well, it's ex-forest that's now being reforested, where they've got permission to put the soil that's come from the composted humans. They've only got 10 bodies in the first intake, and the bodies are... They use the word welcomed into a a kind of a vessel, shall we say, and
like a coffin.
It's nothing like a coffin. Apparently, it looks like a cone, and it's layered with sort of natural things like alfalfa, which is a kind of a grass, if you like.
And this is food for cows.
Yeah,
alfalfa.
Yeah, exactly. And wood chips.
You may have grown alfalfa shoots for lunch. You can grow them yourself for lunch.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people feed it to like their pet rabbits or guinea pigs or things like that too. It's quite common. So they're layered with straw, like another plant, alfalfa, wood chips, and sort of layered with that and put into this nice individual vessel. It's not like you're just thrown in the backyard somewhere. And it takes about 30 days. And the human body breaks down, and you can break down a body in any condition, any size. The only thing you cannot do is compost someone who has died of Ebola, where the CDC recommended cremation, or anyone with a prion disease, you know, the mad cow disease.
There would be a Jacob risk of contamination.
Yeah, Kruzbel Jacob, yeah. So the composting would be not enough, not sufficient to tackle that. But I thought myself, that's very appealing. It's very calm, and you get out of this giant, you know, greenhouse gas producing industry that is usually incredibly expensive. You just go back to Earth.
It's the way that nature intended, really, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. So it's not, I don't find it terribly revolutionary. I find it quite quite natural in a way. It's going back to, you know, back to where we came from. It's kind of pleasant.
And did you say that they were looking to do this sort of thing in France as well?
I haven't found out about whether somebody wanted to do it in France, whether they legally allowed to. I know a lot of people try to have what they call a forest interment, where they, you know, you can choose to be put somewhere and have a tree planted on top of you. But this is actually a sort of a legal business where the body is broken down in that way. And I thought that was terribly interesting.
Ça, c'est fabuleux. C'est une très bonne façon de démarrer une mission pendant le temps de COVID, bien
exactly.
sûr.
Exactly.
Mais on ne va pas penser de la mort pour le moment. On va passer au notre premier morceau. Alors, il y a un morceau par un groupe qui s'appelle Catastrophe. Et ce morceau s'appelle Gromit, que j'adore bien.
Le temps que j'aille chercher un café, déjà 20 minutes de passé, les aiguilles tournent et les heures, le temps fuit comme Dinger. Je suis sous tension, y'a trop d'action, problème de synchronisation, information, que des pulsions, des piles de notifications. À la place du cerveau, comme un sandwich mayo, rien. Message, ça masse les minutes, passe, programme des réveils qui s'enchaînent. La journée derrière moi, le café déjà froid. J'avance encore tant que je suis pas mort. Suis les battements de mon cœur.
J'ai vu des choses. J'ai vu des gens prendre des trains et des avions.
Plus de trous dans mon agenda. On me dit mais t'es sous mandat. Dernière fois que j'ai vu la mer, publicité RER. Pas le temps d'écrire des paroles. J'passe en mode avion, j'm'envole. Tout filé, passe besoin d'espace. Heureux comme Gromit et Wallace. Heureux comme Gromit et Wallace. Gromit et Wallace.
J'ai vu des choses.
Vous êtes dans le Slam 90.8 Radio Campus Grenoble et nous sommes là maintenant, pas dans le studio parce que c'est le temps de Covid, mais dans nos bureaux avec deux doctorants de l'Université Grenoble-Alpes et l'Institut Larry Langevin. Je voudrais souhaiter bienvenue à Shelby Turner. Bonjour Shelby.
Salut.
Et à Daniela Regadas-Teo. Bonjour Daniela.
Bonjour.
Nous avons les deux thésards. On va faire cette partie en anglais plutôt. Je vais commencer un peu avec Shelby. Shelby, welcome. Welcome on the slab in English this time.
Yes.
So you're a student here at the University Grenoble Alpes and at the Institut Larry Langevin, but you're clearly not French. Where are you from?
I'm from Texas in the US.
Deep in the heart of Texas.
Exactly.
Sensational. What are you working on here? You're doing a PhD.
Yes, in physics. And so this is a collaboration project with the university and with the Institut Larry Langevin. So I use neutrons to study different thermoelectric materials.
Okay, thermoelectric. What do you mean by thermoelectric?
Right, so this is a very interesting topic, I think, because it has to do with the conversion of heat into electricity. And I think it's very important today to talk about green energy methods and how we can, you know, recycle heat, for instance, in large factories or even exhaust heat from your cars. And thermoelectric materials are what allows us to do that. And it turns out that there's some materials that are better than others at doing that. And so part of my PhD work, in fact, is to discover what materials those are. And in order to do that, we need to look at which materials can conduct electricity very well, and then which materials do not propagate heat very effectively, which will allow us to make a more efficient thermoelectric material.
But how does the process work then? You have a material, you heat it up, and you get electricity out of it?
Yeah, that's essentially it, in fact. So we take the waste heat from a factory, or again, like the exhaust heat from your car, and we cycle that through some kind of circuit in order to have some electricity at the end. As I was saying, there's some specific materials that are better than others for allowing us to have efficient electrical conductivity without losing a bunch of heat in the material. And that's done because we still allow electrons, which would control the electrical conductivity, to propagate and run through the material. But we limit the heat that would be occurring in that process. So what I mean is that there's another kind of quasi-particle that we call phonons, which are responsible for allowing heat or not to propagate in certain ways through a material. And if we limit those phonons, if we limit their propagation, then we allow the efficient conduction of electricity.
Okay, so just run me through. What's a phonon?
So the analogy that I like to use, because I think that electrons are maybe more commonly understood, the analogy I like to use is the electron. So when you think about a current running through a circuit or in your house or something, we know that that current is made up of particles, which are electrons. And they flow at a certain rate and have all of these very specific properties because of the material that they're running through and all of these things. And phonons work mainly the same way, in fact, because we know that there is, in fact, a small particle that is responsible for propagating heat in the material. So I mean that you have to visualize the fact that that particle is actually going to flow through a solid at a certain rate, again, in a certain direction, and for a certain amount of time. And that's what's going to allow microscopic components of heat to flow from point A to point B, just like an electron in the current.
So a phonon is literally a particle? It's actually a material that goes through your sample or through your material?
So this is the fun part, I think, because we have to simultaneously think of phonons as a particle with actual particle qualities. And we also have to think of them as propagating waves because, in fact, we talk about them as a particle. But I said I worked with solids. And if we think that that solid is actually made up of millions and millions and millions and millions of atoms that are aligned in a certain way in order to form that macroscopic solid, well, that particle is going to travel in certain ways because of the alignment of those atoms in the solid. So we have to consider it as a particle because it has these types of properties, but we also have to consider what would happen as the unit of heat is, I keep using the word propagating, but traveling through this, lattice of atoms.
So you have phonons inside a material, and you somehow limit the phonons, and then you can get electricity out of it. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And so my PhD is focused mainly on understanding the phonons in certain materials, but ideally we would want to as well study the electrons in a material. So we already choose materials that are known for good electrical conductivity, mostly doped semiconductors. And then we try to control the propagation of heat through phonons. So phonons, kind of like electrons, have a certain direction that they propagate at, a speed that they propagate at, and a what we call lifetime that they will propagate for before dying or being scattered, as we say. And so if you can somehow manage to control some of those properties and limit the phonons, without interrupting the doped semiconductor electrical properties, then you can have an efficient thermoelectric material.
I have a question, sorry. I would be interested to know, if we have time, to know how you make these samples, if you could explain how you make these materials.
So I'm very sorry to say that it was not me. We have a wonderful, wonderful collaboration with a lab in Germany. And it's a lab full of chemists who really specialize in these techniques. But this is very fascinating, I agree. And in order to use the neutron techniques that I use, we need a very large sample, in fact, something like 1 centimeter squared at least in order to
make these. That doesn't sound very big.
Well, it depends who you talk to. The people who use X-ray techniques will tell you that it's very large. But I think this is interesting because if you think about the overall research timeline of a project, we first need, wonderful chemists who are going to be inspired to create new materials. And this itself takes a very long time to develop the technique in such a way that it's of high quality and, worthy of studying in a lot of experiments. And then after, a long time of developing this technique, I come along and I say that I need a much larger sample. You have to change your technique in order to provide me with a very high quality and large sample.
And
so actually,
what?
Yes. So this has actually been a very long-term project, in fact, and I'm only really coming in at the end with my neutron techniques. And so I find this very interesting too, how they do develop these samples. And for the samples specifically that I use, they use the Charkowski method in order to grow a very large single crystal solid. And I hope that I can learn more about that in the future because it is a very important part of my experimental results as well.
Okay. And then what brought you then, why are you doing this here in Grenoble?
So Grenoble is a really, really wonderful place to study science, in fact, because we have opportunities such as the ILL, where I have access to a nuclear reactor and neutrons. But as well, we have a synchrotron next door, so I can use similar techniques, but with X-rays in order to study my phonons. And I would as well say that we have access to really high quality research and labs that are going on in the city. There's a lot of access to the CEA and government projects next door, the large university across the city. And for me, it was this really great opportunity to have access to all of this super cool, high quality science.
Cool. And how far into your studies are you?
I'm in my third and final year now, so hey. I'm hoping to defend sometime in July next year. So do wish me luck.
And then the long-term goals are to try to turn these into some sort of apparatus or device, right?
Yes. And so speaking of this big, long timeline, I am pretty far along in terms of the development of the samples, but I would say that there's usually still quite a delay between what I'm studying and seeing it on the market. However, I think it's very cool because some of the materials that I'm studying, such as the clathrate material and also yttria stabilized zirconia, which is also used as kind of a thermal coating for certain systems, for certain applications, these are actually on the market now and being developed in wafer fabrication facilities, and then we get to actually see their use out in the real world. And I think this is really cool because it shows that these are worthwhile materials to study, and there's still a lot to be learned about these materials, which is why they should still be the focus of research projects like mine.
Very, very excellent and nice summary of why they should continue to give you money to do research.
Yes, please. I really like what I'm doing.
Formidable. On est là avec Shelby Turner de l'Université Grenoble-Alpes, UGA, et l'Institut Laue Langevin. On va prendre une petite pause maintenant. On va écouter, bien sûr, le morceau australien de l'émission. Et ça, c'est un morceau par Tash Sultana. C'est quelque chose de très doux, très molleur pour une mission comme la nôtre. Il s'appelle Mellow Marmalade. Gotta leave your bags at the door, but I didn't wanna talk it through. Say things I don't give a fuck about. No, didn't wanna be next to you. I was feeling sorry for myself, and I like my ex and me side up. Shut up. Call you little mama, little mellow yellow. The way you touch my soul, you
Okay, you'll tell me what did that song I heard it playing on the radio, but I didn't wanna talk it through. Slight things I don't give a fuck about. No, I didn't wanna be next to you, 'cause I was feeling sorry for myself. And I like my ex. So need that I said a problem with you. And now I'm stuck here, you're living my life with a pessimistic view. So bring me, girl.
Très mellow. J'adore cette morceau. Bon, on est revenu on the slab et maintenant on est toujours à l'Institut Larry Langevin et cette fois on est en train de parler avec un autre étudiant, un autre Tessa de l'Université Grenoble-Alpes et l'Institut Larry Langevin et cette fois c'est Daniela Regadas-Teo. Bonjour Daniela.
Bonjour.
Et on va faire cette partie aussi en anglais. Hello Daniela.
Hello again.
Hello again. Right, so you're doing your PhD as well at the Institut Larry Langevin, but you're not working on thermoelectric materials. You're working in nuclear physics. Is that right?
Yes, nuclear physics.
Okay, what exactly in nuclear physics are you doing?
So I do nuclear structure of exotic isotopes. So that means that we study the structure of nuclei that are very far from stability. So it's not nuclei that you just find lying around, but you need to produce them somehow. And we use fission for this.
Fission, so how does fission work?
Okay, so fission is when we talk about fission in general, it's just simply one object splitting into different parts. So if we take, for example, an example from this confinement period where everyone's baking bread, imagine that you have your like sourdough, a big ball of sourdough, and you just split it into two fragments. This is basically fission. What I study is not bread, but happening in a much smaller scale, in the atomic scale. So the atom has a nucleus at its center. And when we talk about nuclear fission, it's this center of the atom that is splitting into different fragments.
Okay, and how do you manage to get that? I mean, breaking sourdough is pretty easy. How do you split a nucleus?
Well, it depends what nucleus you want to split. So depending on what nucleus you want to split, it can be harder or not. So some very heavy nuclei split spontaneously. And some, the typical fission example, like uranium, that is what is used mainly in power plants and what I use for my experiments, you need to bombard it with neutrons. It will not spontaneously split into two parts, but if you have a neutron beam that the ILL provides, you can cause a fission on the uranium.
Right, so you get some uranium, you put it in this neutron beam,
yes.
And then that splits the nucleus.
Yes.
And then what do you do with it?
So I look at the two fragments that it forms. Because in fission, there's three main things that you can get out of the reaction. You can get the fragments, the neutrons, or the energy. And I focus on the fragments. In this case, it's not like splitting the dough of sourdough into two parts, because if you split the dough into two, you get two smaller breads. Here, I'm not getting two smaller uranium atoms, because since I'm splitting the number of protons into two, typically two fragments, you're changing your element because the element is defined by the number of protons it has. So when the uranium splits into two, it will form two fragments. and these are very exotic. As I said before, they're very far from stability. One of these possible fragments is krypton, and I study the krypton that comes out of this nuclear reaction.
But people have known that you could split the uranium atom since the 1940s. Haven't they learned everything by that now?
Yes, so we've passed the 80-year anniversary recently. It's been discovered 82 years ago. And you're right that it's pretty impressive that we still don't know everything about the fission process, despite it being used for energy and for many different applications. The fission process itself is still unknown in some aspects. For example, what the fragments that come out of the fission are. So depending on the nucleus that fissions, you can have two fragments, you can have three. Even if you fission the same nucleus, there's different probability distributions that you will get one fragment or another. And we don't have a theoretical model that predicts the fission yields. So when I speak of yields, I mean probability of getting a particular fragment or not. So this is one of the unanswered questions in fission, how to predict what's going to come out of your fission reaction.
And I guess by studying these fission fragments, you can learn more about the nucleus they came from. Is that right? Or the physics of the nucleus that they came from?
You can. You can, of course. You can learn about the fission process, knowing and measuring the excitation energy of the fragments that are produced. So this is possible to obtain information of the process from this. I am not so interested in the fission process and look just at the structure. So I'm just using fission as a tool to produce something that I can't get in any other way.
And you said that you were interested in krypton. What's about krypton then?
Nothing to do with Superman, I don't think.
No, nothing to do with Superman.
Damn!
No, unfortunately. Yeah. But it is, however, very interesting because it's in an interesting region of the nuclear chart. So the nuclear chart is like the periodic table for the nuclear physicist. And krypton lies in a region, in a mass region of nuclei that have approximately mass of 100. And they have this interesting characteristic that makes them change shape just by adding one neutron. So typically in other regions of the nuclear chart, as you add neutrons, your nucleus will get bigger, but there will be no drastic change. Everything is very progressive and continuous. But in this region, you can have a nucleus that is completely spherical with, for example, 58 neutrons. You add two neutrons and you have 60 neutrons and it completely changes its shape. So this is a phenomenon that has been known for quite some years, but is still not well understood.
So hang on a second. How big is a nucleus?
So a nucleus is, well, depends on the nucleus, but of the order of the femtometer, so 10 to the minus 15 meters.
So that's a zero and then a decimal point and then 15 zeros and then a one.
Of a meter.
15, 1 5.
Yeah.
And you can measure the shape of that.
Well, not directly. I mean, it's not like we just see what comes out of our fission reaction and see that we have really tiny spheres or really tiny rugby balls. But what we use to measure the shape are the gamma rays that they emit. So these nuclei that we produce are produced in very excited states. They have a lot of leftover energy. And this energy can be released in the form of a gamma ray. And the energy of the gamma ray carries information about the structure, and you can deduce the shape of the nucleus with the gamma rays.
And how do you probe it? How are you measuring that?
So we measure the gamma rays using an array of germanium detectors that are just gamma ray detectors, and we put just a kind of cylinder around our target position that measures all the gamma rays coming out of the fission reaction.
And depending on the shape, you get a different distribution of gamma rays coming off. Is that right?
It's more that the gamma rays will let you infer the energy of the excited states, and the ratio and the structure of the excited states will have indications of the shape of the nucleus. So it's not exactly that, okay, I have a gamma ray at 100 MeV, I'm sure this is spherical, but you need to look at the different levels of the nucleus to then be able to extract this information.
Okay, and you started your PhD When did you start your PhD?
Almost at the same time as Shelby, I think just a month later. So I'm also in my third year.
So you're looking to defend soon as well? Or just
in the coming year? Yeah, in the coming year, 2021, yeah.
Cool. So, and what have you learned about Krypton so far?
Well, we've learned that it's in the border of this region of drastic shape. So it looks like the changing of shape in this region is a bit more smooth than one could expect. And also that it exhibits, there's indications of shape coexistence. Because another difference compared to bread, these are quantum systems that can have several shapes at the same time. They have shape coexistence. And we've seen evidence of this in the Krypton, which is...
Things can have shape at the same time, different shapes at the same time.
Yes, yes.
Could you just describe that a little bit for us? That sounds amazing.
Okay, so let's say that the shape of a nucleus arises from a particular configuration of its protons and neutrons. And when you have certain configurations that are very similar in energy, but that give rise to very different shapes, since they're similar in energy, they're competing. And you have a probability that you have the nucleus in this state or in the other state because they have similar energy. And the result is that you have a shape coexistence. You have both at the same time.
So it's like the Schrodinger's cat thing where it's not alive and dead at the same time. It's two different shapes at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, you can make that comparison, yes.
Cool. And, well, yeah, you came to Grenoble specifically to study this?
Yes, as similar to Shelby, I was quite attracted by the big facilities in Grenoble. It's a great opportunity to be in a big lab and be involved in many different experiments. And there's all sorts of science that is being done at the ILL. So you...
We forgot to ask you, where are you from originally?
Oh, well, a bit from everywhere. No, I mean, the short answer, I guess, is Mexican Spanish. I'm Mexican family, born in Mexico, but lived most of my life in Spain.
Okay, so then you did your previous studies in Spain and then came to Grenoble from Spain.
I did my bachelor's in Spain, I did my master's in the UK, and then I came to France.
Oh, wow.
So I really like moving around.
Fantastic. Well, what I'm going to do, thank you very much, that's brilliant. What I want to do is ask you both now, this is the obvious question to be asking PhD students, especially when they're looking to finish. What are your hopes for the future? Where do you plan to go from here? Maybe Daniela first.
That's a hard question. I think there's two questions you don't ask a PhD student in the final years.
And that's one of the sorry.
How's the thesis writing going and what are you doing after? But I think I really enjoy what I'm doing. I would like to try and stay in science and keep studying this. I also really like teaching. So maybe if I can combine research with teaching or some science communication, something like this would be great.
Well, typically that would be a job in a university, wouldn't it?
Yeah, something like this. Yeah. They're a bit hard to come by, but...
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, this is another question. Is getting a job like that is entirely possible. The question is where you get it. So I don't know what the situation is. I'm very lucky to have a job, although I had to move a long way away from home to get one. How about you, Shelby?
Yeah, I feel a bit like Daniela. It's the ultimate third-year student question, but
don't ask me that question.
No, I feel quite the same way, though. I think, I'll never forget the first time that I had an experiment in one of these large facilities where I was working with x-rays, but it's, you know, it's the whole idea that the entire room is your experiments and that you're controlling, you know, these things just totally beyond what I thought, you know, science was capable of. And I think that hasn't really faded for me yet. I really do love these aspects of the excitement of discovering something new and working with these amazing techniques. So I hope too that I can stay in research and continue, especially with these neutron techniques that I use, because it's just so cool and I really enjoy it.
Getting paid to have fun. That's always great.
That's the dream.
Bon, un grand remerciement à Shelby Turner et Daniela Regueras-Teo. Merci beaucoup les deux thésards dans la dernière année de l'Institut Larry Langevin et bien sûr de l'Université Grenoble-Alpes. On va passer maintenant à une petite pause et on revient tout de suite.
Vous êtes On the Slab Radio Campus Grenoble. Suivez-nous sur notre page Facebook On the Slab Grenoble.
Vous êtes On the Slab 90.8 Radio Campus Grenoble. Et normalement, ce morceau de cette partie de notre émission, c'est lié avec une radio trottoir quand on passe à la rue et on demande les questions à vous. Et ensuite, on enregistre vos réponses pour nous amuser. Mais c'est quasiment impossible de faire quelque chose comme ça pendant cette période. Donc, on va essayer quelque chose un peu différent cette fois. Et c'est Lucille qui a géré tout ça. Donc, Lucille, qu'est-ce qu'on va faire exactement?
Alors, l'idée, c'est de proposer des petites expériences à faire chez soi.
OK. Quelque chose en sécurité, j'espère. On ne va pas exploser la maison.
Ouais. Alors, j'ai un livre qui s'appelle « 101 expériences étonnantes à faire chez soi » de l'édition Le Courrier du Livre. Et je me suis pas mal inspirée de ça. Et j'ai cherché, bien sûr, des choses simples à faire à la maison et qui ne soient pas dangereuses. Parce que, bon, je ne veux pas être responsable de ce qui pourrait se passer chez vous. Et pour ce premier exemple, je voulais quelque chose d'assez simple, de très basique. Et en regardant par la fenêtre, j'ai vu ce temps un peu maussade d'automne. Je me suis dit, il faut que je fasse quelque chose de thématique en rapport avec, ce qui se passe en ce moment. Et en ce moment, voilà, il y a plein de nuages. Du coup, j'avais envie de vous proposer de faire un nuage à la maison.
Un nuage dans la maison?
Alors, pas dans la maison, mais dans un bocal, déjà. Parce que dans la maison, ça ne va pas être cool, quoi. Et s'il se met à pleuvoir chez vous, ce n'est pas top.
Ça serait cool et humide.
C'est plutôt un problème de plomberie.
Alors déjà, je pense qu'il est important de vous dire, c'est ce qui est nécessaire, le protocole et les éléments nécessaires à la manip. Donc, ce qu'il vous faudrait, c'est un grand récipient en verre transparent pour contenir de l'eau. Il faut donc de l'eau, une plaque, des glaçons. Il faut aussi une torche et une pièce dans laquelle vous pouvez être complètement dans le noir. Donc la première chose déjà à faire, c'est de faire chauffer de l'eau et de la verser dans un récipient en verre avec à peu près 2-3 cm de hauteur pour le niveau d'eau.
Chauffer dans une bouilloire,
une casserole, peu importe, vous la chauffez comme vous préférez. Vous la mettez dans ce récipient en verre. Ensuite, vous recouvrez le récipient en verre avec une plaque en métal, de préférence. Et dans cette plaque, vous mettez des glaçons. Ensuite, tout ceci, vous le déplacez dans une pièce obscure et vous éteignez toutes les lumières, vous êtes dans le noir. Et vous, avant d'éteindre les lumières, d'abord, vous posez l'objet sur une table ou le sol, hein, parce que sinon, vous allez tout renverser partout. Donc, vous posez l'ensemble, vous fermez la lumière, vous allumez la torche et vous éclairez l'intérieur du récipient. Et en fait, en attendant un peu, vous allez observer qu'il y aura une sorte de nuage créé au-dessus de l'eau chaude. Et en fait, c'est parce que l'air chaud qui est contenu dans le récipient, qui vient de l'eau chaude, il finit par rencontrer le fond froid de la plaque. Et donc, il y a une condensation. Et c'est comme ça que se forme le nuage. Et vous observerez même qu'il y aura quelques gouttes d'eau, en fait, qui vont apparaître sur le fond de la plaque et ça fera comme des petites gouttes de pluie. Voilà, c'est ma petite expérience à tester chez soi, toute simple, toute basique, pas dangereuse. Je me suis dit que j'allais commencer comme ça avant de me lancer dans des trucs trop compliqués.
C'est excellent. Et ça me rappelle, Erin, tu te souviens, on a demandé une des questions radio trottoir une fois. Combien il pèse un nuage?
Combien pèse le nuage? Et c'est énorme. Tu te rappelles, c'est des tonnes et tonnes et tonnes.
Oui, surtout pour un grand orage de tempête, quoi.
Oui, oui.
Mais maintenant, on peut faire pareil dans la maison, pas un nuage de tempête, mais un petit nuage. C'est excellent.
C'est excellent. Et qu'est-ce qui se passe quand tu ouvres la plaque, en fait? Tu vois, cette petite nuage disperse dans l'air.
Oui, ça va se disperser dans la pièce.
Ça va être vite fait. Ouais.
ça va juste s'évaporer, quoi. Enfin, ça va partir. En fait, ouais. Là, ça forme ça parce que c'est dans un espace clos aussi. Si, dans la pièce, il faudrait, j'imagine, beaucoup plus d'eau pour recréer le phénomène.
Oui. Excellent. Bonne expérience, tout le monde. Et ça serait bien, en fait, si vous voulez, passer à notre page Facebook, On the Slab Grenoble, et montre-nous ou décris à nous comment l'expérience a passé chez vous. Ça serait très intéressant de savoir pour nous aussi. Bon, et ça, c'est la fin de notre émission. Merci beaucoup pour nous joindre. Merci à nos invités aujourd'hui, Shelby Turner et Daniel Regadas-Teo de l'Institut Hilaire Langevin et l'Université Grenoble-Alpes. Merci à Erin et Lucille. Merci d'être là chez vous.
Et oui, on the slab. Un plaisir, toujours.
Toujours excellent. Et un grand remerciement, bien sûr, à Jérémy, Louis et toute l'équipe de Radio Campus Grenoble qui travaille très, très, très dur pour vous amener le bon contenu, les bonnes émissions. Et on vous verra la prochaine fois. Au revoir.
À bientôt. Au revoir.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.